fueled by facts and driven by truth, live from beautiful British Columbia, it's Roadkill Radio. And now here are your hosts, Kerry Simpson and Terry O'Neill. And we are back again, and we are all three united once more tonight. Not only Kerry Simpson, the lovely, ravishing Kerry Simpson tonight, looking absolutely spectacular.
You're trying to get on my good side again, right. Terry O'Neill.
But also the lovely and ravishing Ron Gray, co-host extraordinaire, and I'm Terry O'Neill,
thank
of course.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks for being with us tonight.
You know, Terry, I just had to make it official, you know, because I spent yesterday at the hearing with polygamy, you know, so I thought the more the merrier, you know, on this show. And since how polyandry is okay, but polygamy isn't, you know, I'm just going to bring on the men, babies.
Oh, brother. Well, I won't travel down that road because it's filled with potholes and steep ditches by the side of that road, so I'll stay away from
that's
that.
That's your position, and you're going to stick to it.
That's
you know?
Right, yeah, that's we'll right. See. So that's been your week, has it? Fantasizing about that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Excuse me, I got to race home and make sure that Janet's not listening to the show.
Right. I'll explain.
Okay.
We have quite a show tonight, and a little later in the show, we will be talking about that exact case, Kerry, with Doug Christie.
Yes.
Controversial lawyer who in some people's minds is one of the most respected legal minds in the nation.
You know what?
He's a good lawyer.
Brilliant.
He's a smart guy.
Yeah. Oh,
great defender of free speech, without
a
doubt. He has clients now and again that whatever, everybody deserves a fair shake in the court of law in Canada.
That's
one of the great things
about
this country. Yeah. And actually, I don't think there's a chapter about that in the book of the author who we'll be interviewing in just a few minutes. That's Bill Gairdner. We will be interviewing Bill about his new book, The Trouble with Canada, ellipse, still. Ellipse means dot, dot, dot. Quite a book about enunciating the many faults in Canada. You know, you look at the chapters, and each of them could be a subject for one of our shows because we tend to concentrate on – because we want things to be better, we tend to concentrate on things that are wrong
currently. Well, you know what? The thought just crossed my mind, though, Terry. You know, Bill put it out there the first time in his first book, The Trouble with Canada. You know, if he'd really got it right, we'd have all these problems fixed.
That's
so
right.
It's Bill's fault.
Well, maybe he was just planning to have a second book.
You know, I remember vividly when Bill's first book came out, The Trouble with Canada, he was lionized on the talk circuit. The Reform Party used to have him on their rubber chicken circuit. And CBC had him on and it was. It was a bestseller.
Well, yeah.
When his second book came out, The War Against the Family, because it exposed the fact that he had some moral principles behind his philosophy, the Reform Party dropped him like a hot rock. But the most interesting thing was listening to the CBC interviewer trying to interview this best-selling author and trying to swallow his own tongue because he just could not. It was right here in Vancouver. Right.
I can just imagine. We'll be talking with Bill about that in a couple of minutes. We'll also be talking in tonight's show about a couple of subjects that have captured our attention. Kerry, you've got a little later today. You'll be venting some concerns about.
Well, you know, the choice I now have when I travel through airports, especially in the United States, is, you know, my choice is, you know, do I want to be a porn star? or do I want to give
you
somebody
mean resurrect
a,
your
a
former
a
career? Is that right?
Thrill, you know. Yeah, my former career. Yeah,
sorry.
The pics are all out there, darling. You just haven't found them yet, have you?
Okay. Yeah. But right. You know, you're talking about the American
full
well,
body
sure.
scan.
Right.
Well, you know, but what really gets me is that you know they're bringing this under the guise of security. But you know, as I'm watching the news and these people complying and rationalizing why they would let somebody grope them. You know, under the banner of security, you know, what we're dealing with here, Terry, is and Ron, is I believe, you know, just a movement to condition people to conform, you know, whatever it takes for the state of security, you know, including letting yourself be groped. I can't think of a more telling tale of the compliancy of a citizenry when you're willing to do that. So I think the implications and the directions are this. And I say bravo to the Americans that are standing up, Ron Paul included, right. Saying, you know, let's not do this anymore.
So my question is, have they ever stopped one terrorist with all of the stuff that they're putting people through.
Well, tune in about 45 minutes and we'll have more of Carrie's gripes. I was waiting for that one. And I'll be talking about...
Oh, it's a touchy subject, Carrie.
Yeah, right. And I'll be talking about, and just making a few little small, very legalistic points, I think, but important nevertheless, about the case of Elaine Campione. In Ontario, found guilty of first-degree murder last week for drowning her two young children. I've got a few little points to make about that. So we'll
and you're not exercised about
I mean, just a few little procedural
things. You're in one of those calm, cool, collected modes.
I feel it coming on, Carrie. We better just stop now. Okay. We'll save this because
we'll save
it's late back east. Back east or in central Canada. So we want to get right away to our first guest of the evening. His name is Bill Gairdner, a true conservative, a strong writer, formerly a very strong decathlete for representing Canada abroad, has had many best-selling books, and his new book, The Trouble with Canada Still, has been on the market for a couple of weeks now and is generating all sorts of interest across Canada. We bring you now from... the great central Canadian province of Ontario, Mr. William Gairdner. Hello, Bill, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
Thank you. Fine, and how are you tonight?
Good, thanks.
We're joined tonight on our panel with Ron Gray, one of our co-hosts. He's the former leader of the Christian Heritage Party. You might remember Ron.
Hi, Ron.
Yeah. Hello, Bill.
And, of course, Carrie Simpson, our stalwart co-host and producer of the show as well.
And
say hello, Carrie.
We're having your weather tonight.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know if you were tuned in a little bit early, Bill, but we've already blamed you for every problem in Canada because your first book didn't fix it. So you got a lot of explaining to do, man.
Okay, I'm ready.
Yeah. So you know what? Your book covers an awful lot of ground, and I'm going to attempt to link our second item tonight. Our second big item tonight is the polygamy case here in Canada. Let's start with one of your major points, that passion for which I share, and that is judicial activism in Canada. It seems to me that we have had something in Canada over the last 30 years that we didn't used to have, that has had some positive effects but has also had a lot of negative effects. And that is the judicial activism associated with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. How important do you see this aspect of what's gone wrong with Canada, or the trouble with Canada?
Well, I think very. In fact, you might say that one of the main lines in this new book really is the extent to which a form of law, I call it code law, has been imposed on Canada ever since 1982 via the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and I argue that it's a form of law which is alien to our founding values. Canada basically began as a country which was rooted in the notion of British liberty, self-reliance, that sort of thing, and of course the common law. And people from that tradition knew that the common law was especially valuable because it basically gets rooted in the country, and every document, every license, every contract, every filing cabinet in the country has agreements between virtually hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, and these things end up being adjudicated in courts. Common law is established and itself rooted in the nation. It's very hard to get rid of. But when you bring in something like an abstract Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which has words like, okay, let's just pick the most damaging one, equality, but nobody knows what equality means.
Well, equality means that prostitutes should have the right to conduct their business completely unfettered, without any legal impediment, and moreover, that should be supported by the state, as a judge in Ontario recently decided, right?
Well, I think I'm even digging at something more fundamental here, which is that the word equality is a noun. It's not surrounded by adjectives in the Charter, which means that judges have to interpret its meaning. So this goes back to what you were just saying. And almost everything that our courts are leaning on these days in the Charter is like that. It's either a noun or a verb. It's not an adjective or an adverb. In other words, it's not qualified. So judges have to come up with the qualification themselves, and how do they do that? Not from a common law tradition, but just out of their own heads. Mm. They just decide this is what it must mean because I say so. And so Canada ends up being in a situation where in far too many cases we are ruled by judicial sovereignty instead of parliamentary sovereignty. And in my book, I argue that one of the solutions to this would be to get every judge that we hire to sign a statement to the effect that he will apply the law in terms of its original intent. Because if the intent of the law is supposed to be an expression of the representatives of the people in a democratic nation, then why should judges be allowed to interpret it the way they want? So my view is, if you're going to hire them, this is what they must swear to do. Get rid of the idea of playing around with the law, because if the people wanted the law to be something else, they would have said so.
Well, or people like myself that go to the Supreme Court of Canada and have the law changed while you're there and never having your case heard under the new law.
Yeah.
And yet there's a decision there. But you know what? Terry O'Neill last week came up with a brilliant descriptor of what is going on with judicial activism. And I happen to be tuning in. See what I do? I actually listen.
Terry wasn't here last week, right?
Yeah. Okay. But you said it was etch-a-sketch judicial activism, right?
Etch-a-sketch.
You just shake
it
up, and you turn the little knob and you draw the picture the way you want it to be. And if you don't like it, then you shake it up again. And you know what, Terry O'Neill? I'm using that one. And you're getting full credit in a lot of documents that are going to make a lot of people very concerned.
Well, thank you. Actually, that was just off the top of my head last week.
I just sat there.
Etch-a-sketch judicial activism. Yeah, you got a good point.
Bill, you probably remember about 2 years ago next month when the Chief Justice of our Supreme Court was down in New Zealand, and she said that... She urged judges around the world to be more aggressive, that was her word, aggressive, in interpreting laws and constitutions according to the higher principles that, as judges, they know exist. Do you remember that speech that the Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin made down in New Zealand?
He was asking about Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin's speech in New Zealand. I think it was more like 4 years ago.
Was it that long?
When she talked. Yeah, it was about 4 years ago. When November 4 years ago, when she talked about the judges not only having the right but also the duty to go outside the framework of the Charter and to rely on things such as a concept of charter values that are out there in the air somewhere.
Yeah, well, you'll see a lot of criticism of that in my chapter. It's called Here Comes the Judge in The Trouble with Canada Still. I urge people to, of course, this is a flagrant self-promotion, but I urge them to go get the book and read it. There's a lot of this kind of material in the chapter, which is the focus, of course, of that chapter. The idea that judges are making law in Canada without leave of Parliament. And my view is we don't need two parliaments, you know, so we should stop.
That's the judge's view, too, Bill. It's just that they want to shut down the one that has 318 members.
Well, I know, but obviously this flies entirely in the face of the whole theory behind the reason that parliaments came into being in the first place. And I think it's time for Canadians to stand up and push back and insist on a correction of this. And one way to do it would be to get rid of Section 52.1 in the Charter, which is the section that says the Charter is the supreme law of Canada and all other forms of law are subordinate to it. I would just get rid of that. And then the Charter, okay, even if we kept it, it would be basically defanged in terms of the preeminence of the our common law tradition. And I think it would help us get back to where we belong.
Bill, it's the judicial activism and the charter rights, are they manifestations of a bigger, deeper trend that is also showing up or also results in other problems in the country that you've identified and talked about in your new book, The Trouble with Canada Still?
I think it is. It's kind of the, how should I put it, the icing on the cake. I basically argue in this book that Canada has been put through, notice the words I choose, has been put through a regime change. Canadians didn't choose this. They were put through it. The regime change has been taking place over maybe a 50-year period, and it was sort of capped in 82 with the repatriation, whatever you call it, of the charter. But this basically altered Canada from a nation rooted in British liberty, as I said, to one rooted in the notion of equality or the egalitarian state. Nothing to do with equality before the law, which we always had before this came along, but suddenly we became a nation which codified the notion that all Canadians should more or less have equal outcomes in their lives. This was something that would have horrified our founders, and if you look at another book I happen to have something to do with called Canada's Founding Debates, mm-hmm. you'll see there the stress on British liberty, the stress on self-reliance. You know, these founders were proud to say there are no people on earth more free than the people of these colonies. That's a direct quote. Well, instead, what do we have today? We have I argue that many of the Western democracies, and Canada is one of them, are basically out of control. If you look at the last 50 years, like from the post-war period to now, and you look at a diagram of, for example, net debt or gross debt of these countries, gross direct debt, and all you see is a line going from the left at a 45-degree angle almost up to the right, steady climbing of debt. And in other words, we have a situation where we either are or are rapidly becoming what I call a tripartite society, and I think it's very dangerous. What's a tripartite society? Well, it's a society in which one-third of the people work to create the wealth. Another one-third are employed by governments at some level, you know, federal, provincial, or municipal, or else they do all their contract work with government, so they might as well be employed by government. And all the money that goes to that one-third, of course, is taken from the first third. And the last third are people who obtain significant portions of their annual income from government. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the last two segments will always gang up on the first. Mm. And I think it's a very dangerous situation, and it's one in which many Western democracies already find themselves. Sweden, for example, which actually was a model for Canada in the Pearson Trudeau era, because it was called the Middle Way. In other words, we weren't going to be communist, although sometimes you could sort of wonder what Trudeau was really trying to do with us, because he was buddy-buddy with Castro, and he quoted Mao Zedong in his most famous book, Trudeau's most famous book, which very few Canadians have ever read. It was called Federalism and the French Canadians, in which Trudeau basically laid out his plan for the socialization of Canada, and he cited Mao Zedong as a master of this kind of plotting. But anyway, I lost a bit of my thought there. But the long and short of it is, Sweden was supposed to be the middle way, you know, not greedy American capitalism, not communism, but the Swedish way. Well, the Swedes today are paying for this. They have the highest tax rates in the European Union, and their entire society is regulated minutely. In fact, in the book I cite a scholar named Rosen, who has told us that when he studied Sweden, he was appalled to find that there are hundreds of thousands of young women who are paid by the state to look after the children of the women who are looking after their own aging parents. In other words, it's just a circle.
Okay, listen,
and he calls it economic churning.
Yeah. Listen, devil's advocate time here. And we look at from any time in history, the life we live here in Canada is pretty darn good. Any time across the current history, comparing Canada to most other, to all other countries, Canada ranks pretty well in terms of we're healthy, we live long, we have a relatively high standard of living, we enjoy certain basic freedoms. Yes, there's a lot of things wrong, but I'd certainly rather live in Canada, says the devil's advocate, than in Afghanistan, Iraq, China, maybe even the United States. And I'd certainly rather live in this time in Canada than and the best country in the world 500 years ago, where I could catch disease, where they die at the age of 38 or something like that, as most people did, whether my neighbor from 2 miles away would launch an attack on me, half my children would die before the age of 6, that sort of stuff.
There's no question what you're saying is correct. However, You know, civilizations have a curve. They rise, they hold for a while, and they fall. Inevitably. That's happened all through history. And so the real question I think we have to face is, okay, it's true we have a good life. And by the way, parenthetically, this book is my book, The Trouble with Canada Still, is an act of love, because I say if you don't care about your country, if you're indifferent, you certainly don't write books like this. You just walk away, you go play golf or something.
Yeah.
So this is a very serious book, and one of the metaphors I use in the book is, look, there's a beautiful woman, you've all known her all your life, she has this beautiful beauty spot on her cheek, and everybody says, my gosh, isn't she gorgeous, and that's the way they think of her. And then one day they get the news that that beauty spot is actually a cancer. And suddenly their whole perception of her changes. Like what they thought was beautiful, in fact, had an underlying issue here. Something was going on that was insidious. And I think the job of a writer, at least hopefully, is that the writer peers into the future. He looks at what he sees and he peers into the future. And I say Canada, in many, many respects, is out of control for the same reason that many Western democracies are out of control. First of all, we have structural debt. It just happens to be a symbol of the degree to which we are being held with our noses, held by the noses by our political masters. We can't pay off our debt. 20 years ago, when my first book came out by this title, we were approaching $500 billion in federal debt alone. Now we're approaching $600 billion if we're not there already. And yet, for the first 100 years of Canada's existence, from Confederation until the Trudeau-Pearson Axis, which you might as well call it, it's almost a flat line, except for the wars, where, of course, we had debt, but the idea that people had then was, look, if you have debt in your family or you have debt in your country, you bloody well pay it off. Yeah. If you borrow short term, you buy the things you need, you build the bridges or fight the wars, but then you get busy paying off the debt. In other words, the worst thing you can do is download your consumption in terms of the debt, which is just a register of that, on the next generation.
But Bill, that's actually, Ron and I were talking about that on the way in today, that the, you know, this business about family responsibility and taking responsibility for your own is just non-existent. And I was giving an example of a young couple that unexpectedly found themselves pregnant. Both come from very well-to-do families, but they're not moving in with their families. Instead, they're moving into government-subsidized housing.
Yeah.
You know, there was a time when maybe this is part of the problem. Have we lost the value of shame in this society?
Well, I think... Sure, that goes without saying, because
shame. What's that?
I deal with this in the chapter on the welfare system, because that's another scam that we simply have not been facing. We have institutionalized the notion of poverty and the notion of need, and we have reconceptualized it where it's no longer a privilege to receive something from your neighbor or from your government or whatever. It's considered a right. It's not your fault is the line.
But
was the system that did it to me.
We've gone further than that, though, Bill. We've made an industry out of meeting the needs of people who don't want to meet their own needs. We have this job creation, which goes back to what you were talking about, this ever-growing government machine that has to be fed, and these people are just right in there feeding the machine. And, you know, what is it going to take? Do we need a bit of a revolution? Do people just have to say enough is enough, very much of what we're seeing down in the States? You know, do we elect people only who will say no more public sector employment growth? We're going to stay where we're at till we get this beast under control.
Well, you're talking now about solutions, and I think there are some. If you want me to, I'll just give you a few.
Oh, yeah.
For example, I think we need to bring in, and my last chapter in The Trouble with Canada Still talks about this, I think we need to bring in a very careful and modified way some of the Swiss methods of controlling their political masters, like recall and political initiatives and referendums. And I'm not talking about plebiscites, which is all that Canada's ever had. For example, in that business of Quebec trying to separate in 95, where Chrétien was crying on the phone and begging us all to, you know, not to agree to all that. That was not a true referendum. It had no legal basis. It was simply a national plebiscite. So I'm talking about real instruments of direct control of our political masters, such as the Swiss use 6, 7, 8, 10 times a year, would, I think, help. another one I would recommend, and I'd love to see this brought in. I mean, I'm not saying this is that I've got it perfected, but I'd like to see what I call a fiscal guillotine. It would go something like this. Any government that publishes a budget on which it's running for election and then runs a deficit for 2 years in a row must automatically go to election.
Yeah. Mm. I like the more vivid example that was playing in my head.
Yeah, but I say, you know, you better believe that they're not going to want to run a deficit if they know they'd have to go to election.
See, you're so
and
Canadian,
we would have some
Bill.
Kind of control over them.
Yeah, but Bill, to take it back to the discussion of judicial activism, because you know, in fact, unless there is some discipline over the judiciary, they are compelling the Parliament to make laws, to change laws, to enforce regulations.
That's right.
That redistribute income, whether the government can afford to do it or not.
That's right. Well, we have courts that are actually ordering governments at various levels to spend money.
Mm. Yeah.
This is simply unheard of in our tradition. It's also has happened in America and quite a few states, even at the federal level. So yes, we have to shake down this judicial oligarchy, and I've recommended a couple of ways of doing that in the book. I think it's entirely possible. I think the Canadian people, however, I mean, how many people have you met who've actually read the Charter of Rights and Freedoms? I've hardly met anybody besides myself and a few historians that I know and constitutional scholars.
Are you guilty?
Yeah. I've read it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, most people don't. You got to admit.
We've read it here.
Yeah. Walk down your street and ask your neighbors if they've ever read it.
They like the idea of human rights. They all sound so wonderful.
Yeah, if you ask them what they think of it, they'll say they love it.
Yeah, but do you know what goes on in the name of human rights?
No, they're not. So this is a huge problem, and that's why when people say to me, you know, why don't you run for politics or something? And I say, I wouldn't, because if I did and even had the good luck to get the country operating the way I'd like to, I'm not convinced for a moment that the day I left office, it wouldn't just go snapping right back to where it is now, because as somebody said in a rather indecorous way, it's the culture, stupid.
Right? Just take a pause for a minute here, Bill. I want to let our listeners and viewers know that of course, they're listening to Roadkill Radio here on the Roadkill Radio Network. And if they'd like to join in the conversation, they can call us at area code 604-525-4167 or send us an email. That's the easiest way to get through with a question or comment at roadkillradio@live.ca. roadkillradio@live.ca, and they'll get right through to us here. We've got it up on our screens. We'd love to hear from you. Bill, you know, I'm looking at I go to the big picture thing, and you've covered a tremendous amount of ground in your book, all sorts of subjects that are vitally important to the future of Canada, and I'm wondering a comment you made about how empires rise and fall, and there's a certain inevitability about things. Got me thinking, and got me thinking in this direction is that you often see, read analyses of these sorts of things happening that are accompanied by or have in their midst sort of a discourse on moral and intellectual decadence and how values that led to the rise of a civilization somehow became transformed and decadence took over. People became too fat and happy, too self-satisfied, not in touch with the, as we sort of mentioned earlier in the show, not in touch with the values of the mothers and fathers and forefathers.
The values got vilified.
Yeah.
The decadence didn't take over. I mean, not only did decadence, but we vilified the very core values and structures that built this nation.
Called good, evil, and evil good.
I think, Bill, like you, we three here would not be doing this show if we were satisfied with the status quo if we didn't think anything could be done about it. So we don't think it's inevitable, and we actually, I think what, if I could sum up and speak for all three of us here, that I would say that fundamentally, we are fighting against moral and intellectual decadence. I think that's at the root of everything that we do, is to fight against the decadence, because we don't want this great civilization, this great country, to further decay. Comment, please, Mr. Gairdner, on that.
Well, I agree with what you're saying. So when I said they rise, they hold for a while, and they fall. It doesn't have to be tomorrow. The Roman Empire held steady for a long, long time before it fell, but when it fell suddenly. And something that we need to note is the cruel truth that people can have an awfully good time on the way down. and they tend to do that, especially the rich, especially, you know, the middle and upper middle classes and the rich, of course. Bureaucrats, politicians, people who have, you know, their pensions, their gold-plated pensions and all the rest of it, they have a great time.
Life is a cabaret, Bill.
While the society is falling apart, the people who really suffer, of course, are the lower classes, you know, the poor, the people who don't have those kinds of locks on the good life. And, of course, it gets bad because when people see that it's really crumbling, they become even more insular and they cocoon even more and they start giving up on their old moral standards, doing just what you're saying, getting into more and more decadence and seeing it as normal. A great Harvard scholar years ago, Irving Babbitt, he said, civilization is an act of the will. And if it's if it becomes a question of drift, the direction is always downward.
So, well, exactly. And
we're drifting. See, that's why I wrote this book, because there's about 8 policy areas in the second part of this book, and I think we're drifting in every one of them.
Can you address this fundamental one? Because we ain't going to have a civilization if we don't have people. And if we don't have people.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and part of this moral and intellectual decadence is selfishness. That leads to people choosing just to have that good old Weimar Republic time as the Titanic is sinking, mixing a couple of metaphors there, and not to bother with the trouble of having children. And we are now. So do you have a policy pronouncement that addresses the demographic crisis that this country is entering into?
Yeah, the so-called demographic winter.
Yeah.
And that's... that's announced by what I call the Great Die-Off. The Great Die-Off is coming. There's no question about it. I mean, I think demographers have trouble telling you exactly when, but anybody can see the projections showing the increasing numbers of people over 65 in this country and the decreasing numbers of children under 15. So, you know, it used to be a pyramid with the base at the bottom with so many children and very narrow at the top with the elderly, and now it's actually a column. And eventually it's going to be an inverse pyramid with very few at the bottom and everybody at the top. And then the great die-off comes, and you got a country which is suddenly empty of people. I mean, I think the Princeton Population Center, it's a famous university center for the calculating population trends in the world. Listen to this. They basically said that countries like Italy, which I think has, 60 million population or something, they said they would be... like by 2050, there would be 40 million population. So you just imagine what happens to a country when 20 million people suddenly
and die. They said most of them will not be Italians.
No, but, okay, that's another issue, okay?
Yeah.
And we can talk about that in a moment, this whole multicultural thing, which is such a disaster for places, like for all of Europe and including America and Canada. But I'm just saying, can you imagine what happens when the die-off comes? Because, you know, there's going to be panic in the land because people who own stores that they rent won't have tenants. Apartment buildings will be emptying. Office buildings, you know, the lights are going off. There will be panic in the land, and people don't believe me when I say this, but I think when people panic, they're capable of extraordinary things, including some extraordinarily stupid things. But sometimes, you know, they start moving in the right way for the wrong reasons. And I think when the great die-off comes, governments are going to wake up and panic, and you're going to see them outlawing homosexuality just like they used to. Mm-hmm. You're going to see them kicking out enormous bonuses and privileges and benefits and legal protections to women to have more children. Just like 20-some-odd years ago, people would look at you in a strange way if you told them you had more than 2 children, like you were somehow polluting the planet.
You bet. I was actually called a breeder because I had the nerve to have 4 children.
Yeah, I got 5. I beat you.
Yeah.
I'm glad to know
you're badder than I am, man.
It's all going to change, not for the right reasons. It's going to change out of panic, but it is going to change, and people are going to start accusing you of being unpatriotic if you're not having at least three children.
Well, you know what, Bill? It's so funny on that front because, you know, I always say I did more than my job. You know, I replaced my husband, myself, you know, and plus put two more on this earth to help somebody who just couldn't quite get there, you know?
Yeah.
And I've always felt that, you know, that was a civic duty that we need to do that. I'm delighted to say that, you know, my sixth grandchild is due any day now.
Yeah, good for you.
Well, and you know what, though? But when I hear the demographics that you're talking about, you know, the burden to maintain the society is going to be placed upon the shoulders of my own. And we're going to carry extra weight because we bothered to do what was supposed to be done to keep a nation going.
Well, that's why I say in this book, I think the whole country needs a rethinking of just about everything we've been doing because I think we've been drifting along half asleep. Actually, the metaphor I use is that Canadians are like passengers in a car that's traveling forward, but they're all facing backwards. And, you know, what do they see? They see, for example, a multicultural city. Oh, gee, there goes multiculturalism. It just came into view, and I look at it receding in the distance, and my goodness, we only had three ethnic communities in Canada, or ghettos, whatever you call them, 30 years ago. Now, StatsCan tells us we have over 256 of these things. We have people coming to Canada who want to stick to the values of their countries of origin, even bring us their own laws. Gee, that looks like a mistake.
Nobody was driving, officer. We were all in the back seat singing songs.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is things are coming into our view, and we sort of say, gee, look at that. Look what we did. But I say Canadians need to wake up, turn around, and grab the steering wheel.
You know, Bill, I recently saw a television commercial for a Canadian-made brand of pizza that featured a huge Italian family out in a garden in the sunshine around a big table, and one guy's pouring some wine and begins singing Torno a Sorrento, and it suddenly occurred to me that kind of Italian family no longer exists. Most Italian children have no siblings, no aunts or uncles, and no cousins.
Yeah, the
big families like that don't exist anymore.
Yeah, and they're still living at home when they're 30. But you know, but I understand what you're saying. And, you know, all I'm trying to argue really is that in every one of these policy areas needs a complete rethink. I mean, look at socialized medicine. Here's another one. It just went by the car. We see it going by, but we're not looking forward and studying it. We see it like after the fact, and we go, holy, this program was costing our provinces about 12 to 15% of provincial revenues 35 years ago, and now it's closing in on 50% in Ontario and a couple of other provinces to boot, 5-0. I mean, obviously this can't go on. And then we get to the moral aspects of something like socialized medicine. I argue that Canadian patients are like pets because their political masters are deciding how much medical care they're going to get, precisely how much, or not get, when they're going to get it, and what value it's going to have. I mean, that's what you do with an animal. I think we need to rethink. How come we lost our medical freedom? And then, okay, I won't babble too much, but something like foreign aid. I mean, I've done the work, believe me, and dug up the numbers. Government-to-government foreign aid in Canada, I just looked at 24 countries. You know what we did in 2007? I mean, the numbers are 3 years old because it takes time to get them. But in 2007, Canada forked over $730 million to 24 nations. I just picked them, just like random. That's $750 million, right? And then I went and did the homework and found out that those very same 24 nations turned around and spent $131 billion on military expenditures and bombs and airplanes. And I'm saying, something wrong with this.
Yeah.
Maybe some of these countries should sell a couple of their jet fighters and feed their own poor.
Right, that sounds like common sense. Is that the subtitle of this book?
How dare you, Bill?
Yeah, really.
The trouble with Canada still and the common sense solutions to that.
That's an illegal phrase in this country, isn't it?
Yeah, we don't hear that very often.
Yeah, but Bill, Terry, and Carrie, one of the things that has got us into this pickle is people looking to government to solve problems just like the ones we're describing. Yeah. But surely, Bill, these problems are not going to be solved by looking for another government program or another policy or another law.
Well, I tell you, it goes back to taxation, Ron, because if you can starve the government of money, they'll stop intruding in your life, they'll stop regulating you, they'll stop passing more laws because they're not being paid to do it. We got a situation in which this is supposed to be a country with a significant democratic element. It was never, by the way, created as a democracy. Our founders were terrified of pure, outright democracy, and they saw the Americans as having fallen into that trap and getting into a terrible civil war, fratricide accordingly. So we have a qualified democratic system in our country. Fine. But nevertheless, the theory is that the people are sovereign, and they are supposed to be the origin of the laws in the country. And what has happened, and why are all the Western democracies, no matter what their origin, simply out of control? They're spending themselves into the ground, and this suggests to me that we have not been able to figure out, and that's why I say the democracies have failed. In this one basic sense, we have failed to learn how to control our own political masters. And a lot of what's going on in this book is trying to get us to see why that is so and how to turn it around.
Bill, I have to tell you a quick funny story. I sat in on the opening remarks for the polygamy trial here in Vancouver. Oh. And on Friday, CBC put forward a motion trying to get full coverage of televisions into the courtroom.
Right.
And there's got to be at least 50 lawyers at this place. The gallery's packed with all the kinds of mainstream reporters and all the rest of it. And CBC's up there arguing, and our Chief Justice, Robert Bauman, they're having this very serious discussion about, well, you know, if we have to sit down court and set up your cameras, you know, and on the nights when we're not here, security has to come in. So our Chief Justice says, you know, this costs money to have security and take care of your technicians, and the court's budgets are already quite, you know, strained. And CBC pipes up and says, yeah, that's a problem too, because our budget. And I'm sitting there going, well, both my pockets are involved in this chat, you know?
Yeah, both sides.
And you know what? I don't even think the thought crossed anybody else's attention in the gallery there. Fortunately, this CBC reporter was sitting next to me. I said, you know, do I just call you ding or dong, you know? And, and you know, but this whole mentality about this ever-feeding money that just flows, and even this polygamy, you know, it's all about job creation of an industry. I have started to keep track of the numbers that are going into the so-called judicial institutes of this country for all their little fancy associations of this and that. You know, people have no idea that this octopus that we're feeding is mutating and now has about 1,000 arms that are all going into the same pockets.
Yeah. Well, these governments are so, you see, people don't realize, like, everybody points a finger at business and they say that businesses are only interested in profits. Well, first of all, it's not true. They're interested in business success, of which profits are one of the most important measures, but not the only measure. It's a measure that you can't do without if you want to run a successful business. But then they think that the public sector is somehow sacrosanct because it's not profit-oriented. But I say that the equivalent to profits in the public sector is size. In other words, they may not have profits, but their measure of success is how big they can get. Mm-hmm. No one has ever heard of a government manager who went to his boss or his minister and said, you know what, we really need a smaller department next year and less of a budget and fewer staff. It just doesn't happen.
Well,
and the reason it doesn't happen is because government, you know, companies go bankrupt, they have to close the doors. But governments can go bankrupt with the doors open. Mm. And this leads back to my first point, is that the way they do that is they just decide they're going to tax the hell out of everybody or borrow, which is what Canada's been doing, which is why we're up to $600 billion federally. But if you take unfunded liabilities into consideration, Canada's total debt is around $2.4 billion. And that comes to $150,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country.
Are you meaning 2.4 trillion?
Trillion, sorry. 2.4 trillion, yes. And governments have done that to us as a people. We have not been able to control that process. And the question is why?
Bill, on my bookshelf, there's a Gairdner section, and one of the books on there that comes to my mind right now is The Trouble with Democracy. I don't think that was nearly as big a seller as The Trouble with Canada or The War Against the Family or Constitutional Crackup, but is that book still in print?
It is. You can get it from Amazon. It's a print-on-demand book.
Okay.
And unfortunately, there's a sad story behind that, but it's a very Canadian story. Jack Stoddard, who ran Stoddard, which published that book, that was a division of General Publishing, which was then Canada's largest publisher. He went bankrupt about 2 days before that book hit the streets.
Ouch.
And I had told him 2 years before, I said, Jack, you got to get your hands out of the government pockets. Mm. It's going to come back to bite you. You know, but every publisher in Canada has their arm into the government, right up to the shoulder. In fact, I have a very sad report for you, and that is that my current publisher, which is Key Porter Books, a very distinguished Canadian publisher,
yes,
is in big-time trouble. They laid off 15 people 2 weeks ago, including my editor and my main marketing man. So you better believe I'm on the phone trying to promote this book.
Yes, okay.
Well, we better get it before.
Yeah, go out and buy it, everybody, please,
yeah.
Because that's a very Canadian problem, see? Yeah.
Well, I just got an email about you, Bill, that I should read, and this individual says that he had the pleasure of meeting you last Thursday night in Ottawa, that you are everything that is honest, decent, and proper about Canada.
Oh, my goodness, you're making me blush.
There you go. Your fans are arriving.
Oh, tremendous. Just a final question from Terry here, Bill, or a final point that you can elaborate on. It's one of your first chapters in your book, The Trouble with Canada Still, and that's 8 Popular Illusions, Obstacles to Clear Thinking. Now,
yeah.
You know, if we're going to try to solve the problems, if we're going to try to reverse the moral and intellectual decadence, we have to be able to approach these problems with clear minds. So I want to leave our listeners with some uplifting or at least informative, not policy solutions, but how to look at these issues in a more clear way, how to think about these problems. Can you talk about that chapter and share with our listeners and our audience insights there?
I guess the reason... The reason I included the what I call the popular illusions is because I felt that public discussions were being held in the name of these illusions, not in the name of the truth. And let me just give your listeners an example of what I call the free lunch illusion. You hear people saying this all the time. For example, they'll talk about something that the government does as free. And I always... told my children, I said, nothing is free. It's prepaid.
Right.
And my kids now get a great giggle out of this because they hear their friends saying, you know, that so-and-so that the government is doing is free. Wow. But my kids say, no, it's not free. It's prepaid.
Very good.
You know,
very good.
And this business of the free lunch illusion has to be done away with. People don't realize that governments have no money of their own. Mm. Governments only get money by taxing people, or by borrowing, in which case that's a deferred taxation, or they print money, which is fiat money, which causes inflation. And inflation is just another form of taxation.
Right.
So, in other words, they have no money of their own.
So economic clear thinking, understanding a fiscal framework of the country, that's one way. What's another way?
Another one is what I call the fixed buy illusion. This is the illusion people have, and it actually has come down to us over the centuries through our religious roots and just... from people not really thinking it through and understanding how it works. This is the idea that there's only so much money in the world, or only so much wealth, and, you know, if you pay, if John makes $1 million, somebody else is going to make less, like that kind of thing. Whereas, in fact, what we know is that there are what I call tools of freedom and wealth creation, and the third chapter in this book goes in some detail into the overall title of that chapter is The Freedom System. And it's about the tools of freedom and wealth creation, which I think can be learned and can be taught to anybody in the world who's willing to learn them. For example, we know that if you can learn these tools and get your country into a growth position, say 2% a year, we know that a nation will double its net wealth by this formula. You take 72, for example, you divide by 2, and in 36 years, the wealth of the entire nation is doubled. So whatever the growth factor is per year, you divide it into 72, and you can tell when you've doubled your wealth. Hmm. So it's not true that wealth in the world is fixed. In fact, we know that in 1900, for example, there were about 6 wealthy countries in the world. Now there must be 80 of them, maybe more. And it's growing very fast. I would say the whole world is going to be wealthy if we give it enough time.
Yes. And you have to, for those fixed pie people, you have to ask them, where does all this wealth come from, folks?
Yeah.
If it is a fixed pie. And it's not just general wealth things. It's, just economic growth, even, in a city or a municipality or a province or a region of a country.
Hey, guys, it comes from the government.
It doesn't mean that, I want to reiterate this point, it doesn't mean that if I'm getting richer, you're getting poorer. We can all get richer at the same time.
Yeah, and there may be some point at which countries get too rich, I don't know. Sometimes I've argued that Canada is too wealthy in the sense that we're very materialistic. We are very wealthy as nations of the world go, both now and in history. And it's possible that this has a negative effect on our engagement as citizens, that we become completely blasé, completely turned towards personal and material satisfactions, and we simply turn off our minds when it comes to understanding the damage that we're doing to ourselves. At any rate, these popular illusions, there's more, but
yeah,
what I call the discrimination illusion has to do with the failure of our people to make distinctions between what I call negative discrimination and positive discrimination. And a key point I make throughout the book here is that all social policies that are created by, well, our legislators are in fact positive discriminations. We actually are trying to make a difference with the law. For example, we give veterans veterans benefits, but we don't give them to people who've never been in the military. We discriminate against people who've never been in the military by withholding those benefits. We say to them, you have to qualify if you want that benefit. And the same with welfare. We say you have to be poor, and here's the test. If you're poor, you get these benefits. That's a positive discrimination in your favor, but only if you qualify. Now, by the way, this used to be the case for something of utmost importance, which is ordinary marriage. We used to say, if you want the benefits of marriage in this country, then you have to abide, you have to qualify for it. You have to marry only one person at a time. By the way, this reflects on this polygamy discussion, which is, I don't know where that's going, but that's just horrendous. We used to say, you can only marry one person at a time. In other words, it was number, gender, age, and incest. We said you had to marry someone of the opposite sex. You could not marry someone beneath a certain age, and you could not marry a close blood relative. Now, those were discriminations which were set up in law and in tax policy to protect and encourage ordinary heterosexual marriage, because states, which by the way, I don't believe ought to be involved in marriage at all, except for this one thing. We must survive as a civilization, and therefore the state has a duty and a right to protect the institution of heterosexual marriage. But it has no motive whatever to protect any other kind of human union, which Canada has because we've illegalized homosexual marriage, which is the most ridiculous thing we could possibly have done.
But Bill, let me stop you there. The government does have an interest in that, because look at all the job creation that suddenly came for it, because now we have homosexual couples divorcing in the courts, which add to that whole system.
It's a cynical thing you're saying. It may be true, but it's not. I understand why you said it, but it's not a motive for allowing government
to insert the word legitimate here. The government doesn't have a legitimate interest in
no. No, but here's what's going on in this country, in my humble opinion, and that is that the charter, in the name of egalitarian rights, is being grabbed by individuals who feel that they're being discriminated against negatively. In the case of the positive cases I'm giving you, they're claiming that it's negative because they're not included. And I say, well, all social policy is exclusive. It excludes people who don't qualify. Don't you get it? But the person who doesn't get it says, I'm going to hold up this charter, and under Section 15, I'm going to use it as a battering ram to break down these exclusive social policies which have kept me out. I want in. But they don't want to qualify to be in. They just want the benefits, see? And so this is why I've said for 20 years now that the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms is being used as a kind of legal and moral battering ram to break down civil society, the very essence of which is the protection of these kinds of inclusive, discriminatory social entities. I say discriminatory in the positive sense because, well, we have a reason to protect marriage. We have a reason not to give welfare benefits to everybody, et cetera, et cetera.
You know,
but you can break society down, and if Canadians don't get it, you know, what they're not able to see is that modern states love this. States don't want competition for the loyalty of citizens. So they're quite happy, in fact, to see civil society, which is the only barrier between the government and the freedom of the individual, broken down. Once it's broken down, all you have is a state at the top and millions of individuals wandering around at the bottom, completely unprotected now because they don't have these social institutions such as marriage and family and church and you know, all these kinds of entities which have always had autonomy and privileges that were given to their members. But, you know, I mean, you have for example, a... Let's say a fitness club that you go to, where you belong to a sports club or a fitness club. Your members, you can't use it unless you're a member. You have to buy the membership, et cetera. You have no rights to it otherwise. But these are bonding organizations that create fellowship in human beings. Along comes the government and says, well, we want that fellowship, so we're going to build fitness centers in every town in this country. And we're going to drive these kind of folks out of business, and all these individuals have to come to us.
Yeah, I'm really understanding where you're coming from here, and I think so much of it comes back to this egalitarian path that the country has gone on, which I think, if I can sort of use my own words to describe what you're saying, is essentially there's a little equation here that egalitarianism ends up breeding. Infantilism, in a way, like it turns
us. You said it better than I did. That's right.
It turns us into infants with the state as the nanny state, yeah. And you just described that. I wrote that down here on my paper about 3 or 4 minutes ago. Then you started talking about how basically all these structures are broken down, so we're only left with the state above and these aimless individuals below. That's infantilism. And. And really, when we're talking about moral and intellectual decay, the opposite of that is growth. And it's essentially what I'm saying is we have to grow up as a nation and become real adults, real people with real resilience. We have to stop relying on the state and all looking for fairness and equality. And this reminded Ron of something else that I made up last week, not only just the Etch-a-Sketch judicial activism, but it came with a little description that's sort of a cousin of NIMBYism, and that's ithiwititis, which ithiwit, if they have it, we want it too. And that's part of the infantilism that's around our society now. Mm-hmm. Some group or some city or some municipality, community sees that somebody else has some federal largesse.
I heard it put it differently. Affluenza.
Affluenza. Mm-hmm. Ithiwititis as well. Anyway.
Well, somebody referred to egalitarianism in the sense that we're all discussing here as a universal solvent.
Bill, I remember some years ago, though, hearing you speak when you talked about this, the eventual outcome of this as being the government at the top and all of these unprotected individuals down below. And I remember that you said in between were the little platoons of civil society.
Yeah, that was Burke's phrase, which I stole.
Yeah.
But what we're busily doing is breaking down these little platoons, and the charter is the battering ram with which we're doing it. And that's because individuals can stand up and say, hey, what about me? I want those benefits too. And then the state says, yeah, but you don't qualify. You're not a hetero. You're not going to marry someone of the opposite sex. Well, then you're discriminating against me, you know, and they strike down the law. That's what Canada did. Canada basically invalidated the centuries-long common law on marriage, and they put in the phrase, any two persons.
That's right. And a dozen years ago, you warned if we pulled out any one of those four qualifiers, we would have no basis on which to defend the remaining three.
No, and now we got this polygamy challenge. See, this
it's happening. It's all sliding down the same slippery slope.
Yeah, and today the third leg was actually brought to my attention. The third leg was the one of age, because my daughter sent me an email about a protest against Amazon. .com and .ca, because apparently they have quite a few books for sale on Amazon now which are promoting pedophilia. You know, how to be a better pedophile. Hard to believe.
About that. William Gardner.
Yeah.
We've run out of time. The book is The Trouble with Canada Still. Tell us where we can find this book and how we can buy it.
Any good bookstore in Canada. They're all in the bookstores now.
Okay.
You can also get them from Amazon or from Chapters Indigo websites. And I, of course, encourage everybody to do that because I want to see the culture change.
Well, Christmas is coming. That's sounds right. Like a good gift-giving idea to me.
Yeah, and from this little platoon of civil society to your little platoon of civil society, we salute you, sir. And good night. And
thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being on the show tonight.
Good night, Bill. It's really good talking to you again.
Yeah. You too. Bye-bye.
Good night, Bill. Bye-bye.
By the way, guys, we had an email in from Jane. A little correction. She said the U.S. was founded as a constitutional republic and not a democracy. And in fact, if you read the Federalist Papers, they warned about the dangers of a democracy.
Interesting.
I want to refer again to Bill's other book, The Trouble with Democracy. It's not a light read, you know, but for those who are seriously
interested. And that's why it would be on your shelf.
But for those who are interested, you know, seriously interested in political science and what's going on today, it's really an important read, a very important read.
Thank you very much. I'll keep that in mind.